sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 65. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Today I have a really interesting interview with Dr. Gary Habermas. We're talking about his work on near-death experiences and empirically verifiable aspects of them. I hope you find it as fascinating to listen to as I did to record it. Enjoy! Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Gary Habermas.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you. It looks like we're going to be able to get a chance to sit and chat a little bit about NDEs, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Not a worry. So first up, for people that don't know who you are, can you tell me a bit about yourself?
Well, it's always kind of an odd question, but, you know, when you don't want to just say, well, I'm so-and-so. But I'm a distinguished research professor at Liberty University in the United States, and I taught here for, I think this is my 26th or 27th year, and I'm the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology. Done a lot of book writing over the years, 30-something books, and my chief area of interest concerns topics like the resurrection of Jesus and near-death experiences, basically topics having to do with, let's say, religious topics with a bearing on afterlife.
Okay, so you're joining us for a discussion of NDEs. I guess the right place to start is, what is an NDE and do they come in different types?
Okay, well, near-death experience is kind of, let's say, popularly kind of broke on the Western consciousness back in the, let's say, about 1970. Before that, there was some, you know, kind of that off-the-wall kind of literature, and you'd pick it up here and there, and you couldn't figure out if it was reliable or not. There were some good studies before that time. I'm not trying to say they weren't. But in 1970, in the early 70s, several researchers, including some medical doctors, decided to do some systematic, at least interviewing, if not testing, of near-death procedure. Now, even the category near-death, I remember the days when discussions were even being done as to what the name of this phenomena should be. They're not post-death experiences. And finally, a researcher, I believe it might even have been Michael Sabom, who is one of the better-known researchers in this area. He may have been the one who coined the term, but I don't recall that exactly. And near-death was defined as a reported experience from a time during which a person could fairly be believed to be close to death and from which they would die, a situation from which they would die if they did not get immediate attention. So that's more the, you know, the wordy kind of definition. The actual state might be initial cessation of life signs, pulse, heartbeat, just from a person who is observing the situation and perhaps calls the emergency, or maybe the person's a rescue individual themselves, and they know that this person's in some kind of trouble. And that's the state from which these many of these experiences are reported.
Okay. So what sparked your interest in near-death experiences?
Well, I was just, in the early 1970s, I was, I was coming to the end of a long period of religious searching, and I had been going through a time of being pretty skeptical, probably close to, at this point, close to almost 10 years of being fairly skeptical of particular religious claims. And I, you know, somebody would say to me, well, have you checked this out or have you checked that out? And one of the things that, you know, I'd mentioned to me was this what at that time was not even being called near-death experiences. I'd read a book some years before that purported to give some of these and other type accounts, and I couldn't make sense of whether these books were, these reports were well evidenced or not. So I just started keeping my eyes open for reports on the subject, and as I indicated earlier, the question of afterlife has long been one of my central, if not my central area of concern. So when someone starts saying, I saw heaven, or I was in hell, or I was looking down at my body while they were doing these fantastic things trying to revive me, and at first I didn't even know it was my body, you know, you start listening and wonder what's going on. Then some psychologists and medical doctors started collecting this material and testing when they could, and there were some early groups that would meet together, and I remember about 10 years after that, in the early 1980s, meeting with a group of researchers up in the northeastern U.S., and they're a very serious group of researchers. Probably right now, among this group would be the biggest named near-death researchers, or most of them. And we got together and we discussed some of these things, and my interest has kept up from that time on. But I guess the short answer would be it came from a time of religious searching and especially evidence seeking in my own life.
Okay. Evidence for an NDE, aren't they just faulty brain chemistry as a person dies?
Yeah, and that was the early reports. There would be a list of medical trauma or non-trauma views that would say perhaps near-death experiences can come from one of the following. And among those would be, say, temporal lobe seizure, oxygen deprivation, wishful thinking. I don't think too many people thought much of a thesis such as lies, you know, tell these people are just lying. But you know, somebody would bring that up once in a while. But mostly the medical ones would say, here's what they all had in common. You are in a subjective brain state of one sort or another, and the mere fact that others have experienced a similar state, i.e., light and a review of one's life or aspects of one's life, the fact that hundreds, and then later it's found out thousands, and then in a later survey, millions of people have claimed this phenomena, that can't be considered anything other than a subjective brain experience because other people have had it, that just might mean that all of you have the same brain chemistry. So that might be all there is to it. And part of my search was how I could answer these objections, because those type of objections are very tough ones if you don't have any data, and it seems to me you're going to have to leave the stories right there unless you can do something about it.
Okay, but what sort of empirical data could you claim? I mean, how are you going to verify somebody's trip to the afterlife? That seems all a bit ethereal to me.
Well, yeah, and the whole thing you just asked, there's a number of loaded questions there. I mean, for example, one might be just concerning the afterlife itself. But the major question is, could these kind of experiences be written off as subjective experiences? The way I went after this and the publishing I've done on this, what I decided to do was to, and I'm not trying to imply I'm the only one who did this or that nobody else thought of this, but at the time, a number of us who met in those early groupings and before and since, one of the ideas was to provide evidence that this is more than a subjective brain state. Now, the first thing I'll say is what I did not conclude. I am impressed enough with the criticism, like the one you raised, that I would never say something like, well, the fact that tens of thousands or a few million, according to one survey, by the way, the one I referred to here, almost 8 million Americans alone have claimed to have data like experienced things like this. But I would never argue that, similarities in these experiences show that they went to some common reality. I think they're interesting, but they're rather beg the question of what caused this. So what I did was I started collecting cases, and I now have, well, I'd have to go back and count, probably over 100 now. But I started collecting cases, evidential cases, where somebody would report something that could be verified. Now, just for a simple example, I mean, this will sound fairly complicated, but there are actually better evidenced cases than this. Let's say a person has a near-death episode, a state from which they can, with good reason, said to be close to death, and a rescue team gets a hold of them, and they know that this person was in distress. Let's say they passed out, or let's say, you know, something happened at, let's say, 2:15 in the afternoon local time, and the folks who come to rescue them get them stabilized, let's say, within 45 minutes. Well, if during that time, let's say right in the middle of that 45-minute time stretch, let's say the fellow who, as I earlier said, he reports hovering above his body and first wondering who in the world is that down there on the ground that they're, you know, whose chest they're beating on, who's this guy down there. First of all, he can't see his face anyway because people are over top of him. And secondly, he just normally considers his existence from the point of his consciousness, and he's, you know, 10 feet above that point. So he's observing this and rather amused by the state of affairs. And over on his right or left side, he notices a another kind of hubbub, kind of another kind of attention-grabbing procedure. And maybe 300 feet away, 400 feet away, he witnesses a car accident. And he can describe what car hit what car, what colors they were, apparently what happened. We know the person was out during this 45-minute time, but we also have a police report that says that there was a car accident roughly 20 minutes after the onset of this problem. And let's say that the fella, when he's brought to, let's say he comes to and one of the first things he says is, how's that woman doing who was driving that green car? So they know that there was no time here for somebody to tell them the story. So it's that kind of a thing. And some of them are very, very complicated. Because when you have a heart attack, for example, when you have a real heart attack and not just heart difficulties, what happens within? They know from experiments now, cardiology, that at about the 10 to 12 second mark, you have a flat brain wave reading. So you could potentially very soon into a heart attack have no heartbeat and no brain waves. And if you plug that into the situation and the person reports a car accident from 20 minutes later, well, that becomes very evidential.
Okay. What does a flat brainwave activity mean effectively, though? Couldn't it just be below the level of what the instruments can measure?
Sure. And that's a good question. What does a flat brainwave mean? Well, first of all, if I were just to play off your question and I could say, I could make this kind of philosophical response. I could say, all right, let's grant that the cords for the EEG and the cases where it's actually hooked up, let's just say someone hooked it up improperly, or let's say it only measures higher level brain activity, not lower level brain activity. My comeback would still be, assuming you have a case, and there are a number of them, where a person reports data with flat brain and flat heart, the EKG, you'd still have to say that if there's no known, if the heart's not working and there's no upper level brain activity, that would have to still be very, very significant. And if the person said, well, it could be lower level brain activity, there's a certain type of philosophical response at one level where you want to say, well, the person says, there could be lower level brain activity, and you respond, well, there might not be. And the person says, there could be, and you say, there might not be. The point you're trying to get across there is just to assert something, there could be, doesn't make it true. That's just, you know, one quick comeback. But then you have to go in there and spend a little bit of time and say, well, let's just say for the case of the question that there was lower level brain activity. Why would we think that an experience that is highly evidenced and the person says it's the most significant thing that's ever happened to them in their life, let's add that there's a profound life change, which there almost always is. There's a profound life change. The person is no longer afraid of death. They're much more willing to help other people. They become a much kinder, well-balanced person. Why would I believe that all of those results could come from lower level brain activity when this seems to be a very high level experience and results? So, so you could say, well, yeah, there could be some lower level brain activity there, but that doesn't explain the richness of this whole situation. And besides, there's a third type of response, and it would go something like this. You're telling me there's no brain wave material, as far as we know, on the higher brain function. But if this person had a heart attack, this person had a real heart attack, as far as we know, there is no brain activity, period. That's what research shows, totally apart from any NDE research. Research as to what happens to a brain when the heart is not working is that the brain does not function very quickly afterwards. So the one level says, what about what we're, the waves, brain waves we're seeing? But the other type of response is that with heart-type cases, there's no brain activity. And if you're believing that the person had the most meaningful experience they ever had, and it was highly evidential, I think we're talking about some other things going on here and not relying on low-level, undetermined, unverifiable brain-level activity.
Okay. That's an interesting response. The way you're essentially turning the skeptical argument on its head like that.
Yeah, well, you have to... it was very easy for me to think like that because I went through these years of this sort of thing myself, and sometimes, this is not often appreciated, but sometimes, just like people who used to be religious and they're not religious now, have some of the best insights into what religious thinking is like. Sometimes people who were on skeptical quests throughout their life have the best sense of what it means to be skeptical. And I certainly thought that was me, because regardless of what I was inclined to believe or not believe, the question of whether there was evidence for me was a totally different issue, and I wanted there to be evidence. I'd come to the conclusion very early on that there was no way I wanted to have a kind of faith that said something like this. I believe these things. I don't know any of them are true, but that's just my brain state, and that's just what I believe. And so, quote unquote, that's true for me. Well, that's wonderful, but true for me doesn't tell me anything about the world, and I'm not going to live in illusion. So it was easy for me to think that way.
Okay. So I guess the obvious criticism that comes to mind of near-death experience reports is, well, they're not really dead, are they? These people are clearly, from whatever state they're in, are still alive. Well, at a later date, are still alive.
Yeah.
How can you feel?
Right.
How do you deal with that?
See, to me, Jason, that's to me is an extenuation of the previous question. That's just another way to ask. Well, what you're saying is, they're not dead. How do you know they're not dead? Well, because they're only near death. Okay, in a lot of cases, that's where the discussion stops. It's near death. But what about the flat brain cases? Well, there could be some lower activity. Okay, and so we're right back to the question before. But to the general question, what happens if this is a near-death state, and we don't finally know what's going to happen when the brain is not operating, I still would say, okay, what about cases of heart attack cases where there's no brain or no heart? We know that there's no brain activity via cardiac experiments that have nothing to do with NDEs. We know there's no brain activity after, say, 20 seconds, not with a real heart attack. And I have experience beyond that point. But there also there's another species. See, in one of my treatments of near-death experiences in a book called Beyond Death, which I co-author with J.P. Moreland, a philosopher, I have levels. I have definitions of death. And I ask, do we have any data beyond each of those points? And I've already kind of assumed those, except for the last one. And those levels would be, this guy's near death. He's only near death. Okay, so what do we have for him if we have evidence? We have a hint. We have a hint of an afterlife, but like you say in the question, it's a very good question, he's only near death. Okay, what's the next highest definition, the next stricter definition? Heart death. Okay, what happens in heart death? Well, you know, here's your medical explanation of what happens in heart death. And you say, well, people come back from heart death all the time. Yes, they do. They come back from flat heart wave measurements, EKG. They come back from those all the time. But it's not the coming back that we're talking about. It's talking about what they experienced during that heart attack episode. Okay, then the next toughest one is the EEG, the flat brain, and it's much rarer to come back from flat brain experiences. Probably the number one category of people who come back from that are people who fall through ice in a lake or something, and they're sort of suspended animation. But for the most part, you don't have too many people who come back from flat brainwave situations. And so now we're getting stricter and stricter and stricter on this definition of death. But there's a fourth level, and that concerns, what about a person who in a near-death state, if instead of the car accident I'm talking about earlier, what if they, because it's very, very common to meet people. It's very, very common to say, I saw deceased loved ones. I saw my parents. I saw my grandparents. And, of course, the response is, well, of course you did. They're the people you would want to see. They're your loved ones. You haven't seen them for years. You love them very much. Of course you would conjure up images of them from when they were alive and from when you were with them. But there is a type of near-death experience, and they're fairly common. I mean, by fairly common, I mean, I don't mean there's many, many, many of them. I just mean there's more than one or two of these examples I'm given. And let's say that the person they report being with after death is a person who, there's different forms of this. One form would be they're with a person who they did not know died. They say, there's my grandparents. Yeah, they've been dead for 10 years. There's my mom. She's been dead for 3 years. But what was Bob doing there? You know, my cousin Bob who lives in Japan, or my cousin Bob who's in the service. And, you know, he's over here in this country or that country. And then it's just kind of a conundrum. It's just kind of a surprise. And then the near-death experience is over, and you find out later that your cousin was killed in battle, let's say, at that precise moment, or died of a heart attack in Japan within the last hour, something like that. So there are cases that involve others who just died. There are also near-death experiences of somebody who's been dead for quite a while, but they learned something that they did not otherwise know about that person, and it's very, very hard to explain that data outside of the person having told them. So that gets past the flat brain objection, you know, more straightforwardly.
Okay. That is certainly a strange phenomenon to encounter, meeting someone you think is alive in a near-death state and then discovering they're dead. How do skeptics of these sort of phenomena deal with cases like this, or do they just ignore them?
I would say in one of two ways. They typically ignore them, and maybe the ignoring comes in their defense. Maybe the ignoring comes from not hearing this stuff. Maybe the ignoring comes from too many believers in an afterlife saying flippant things like, well, 10,000 people who've seen light after death can't be wrong. No, they could be wrong, because 10,000 people have similar brain chemistry. Or, well, of these 10,000 people, 40% of them were with deceased loved ones. Well, okay, maybe deceased loved ones are important to them, presumably, because they lived with and loved these people. And, you know, so I think some skeptics, at least in the old days, the years ago, they used to respond to the reports of light and a good feeling and seeing loved ones. It's just normal subjective brain phenomena. So that's one reason they respond on that level, and they say, well, this could be subjective. Another way they respond, of course, is the brain state objection, that answer that we gave earlier. This is a temporal lobe seizure, or this is a cerebral anoxia, you know, oxygen deprivation. Lately, there's been a new response. There's been two experiments that I know of just recently where when you stimulate the temporal lobe in a person's brain, you can, there's a lot of debate about what's going on, but at least the scientific tests reported that they induced out-of-body experiences, not near death, because the person's nowhere near death, but the person started looking at themselves from outside their body. There are some reports that you can duplicate these things by stimulating the portion of the brain, and of course the natural comeback is, well, you see, there's a natural mechanism right there. There's a place you can stimulate to get all this. So what we thought, very natural phenomenon, i.e. the earth is round after all instead of flat. So that's probably a comeback that isn't here yet, because this data are just now starting to come out. But, you know, I think what's the problem with all these kind of responses, the similar brain chemistry, we're all alike, aren't we? We can duplicate this in a lab by probing this area of the brain right here. I think virtually every report, there's not a skeptical comeback, of which I'm aware, that deals with these evidential cases. And now they're gaining more and more in number. In fact, these have been written up, the evidential and other, I mean, just the plain near-death phenomena. I have a count of at least 10 to 15 different medical journals in which these accounts have appeared. A lot of them are not evidential. They're simply medical reports on numbers and experiences and things like that. But there are some evidential ones that are coming up now. And the problem with the skeptical comeback is that they can't really account for evidential cases. Let's say I can probe your brain, if I were qualified, I'm not, but if I could do that kind of experiment and you said, oh, well, I'm looking down at myself, or I saw this, and that's, you just must have pushed the right button. I'd say, well, did you see something a mile away that you can report? No, I was just looking at myself here in the laboratory, and it lasted 8.3 seconds. That's how these reports run. You'd say, well, you know, that may or may not be a subjective state. We can't tell. But one thing's for sure, you're not explaining these evidential cases. In fact, one of the two articles that just came out of these experiments, intriguingly, the article in the New England, I believe it's the one in the New England Journal of Medicine, it ends like this. It says something like, my memory of it is something like, what this says about near-death experiences is unclear, because the cases in our laboratory were not in the presence of any kind of difficult circumstances, so we don't know to what extent this can even explain that. When you throw in there, not only is it not near death, but there's no evidential data, I mean, that is the thing to explain. You have to explain how people can report things and it can be verifiable when their brain and or heart or even their bodies are in states from which they shouldn't be able to see and report these things.
Okay. So I guess the obvious question is, if these weird evidential near-death experiences exist, and the evidence would seem to suggest that they can't just be written off as some sort of weird brain chemistry or something like that. What do you think it does point to?
Well, I think the best argument, I think the best indication of the argument is that you're dealing with some sort of consciousness after successive, I had these successive definitions, after successive points of near death, heart death, brain death, and then, of course, in some of these cases, you're talking about people who've been dead for a long time. So I think what the best conclusion that I can come up with in about 35 years of looking at this data is that we're talking about consciousness of some sort after death. I call it, J.P. Moreland and I, in our book Beyond Death, we call it a Christmas morning view of an afterlife. And what we mean by that is it's sort of like kids waiting for Christmas morning. You can expect something, but you don't really know what you're going to get. You don't really know what's going to be there. One thing, I will tell you some things I don't think come from the data. I don't think the data tell us which religion is true. I think they can start. I think they can start making us think religiously, but I don't think the data indicate that one religion is true and another one is false. I don't think the data indicate that all religions are true. I don't think it tells us either one of those, and I don't think it even tells us whether you live forever. Or whether it's, if you only use near-death data, I think you have to use other data to talk about living forever. But only on near-death data, you could say, well, we got something here for some years. Because I say years because that last category, if it's true, they report people who've been dead for 20 years. And the person reportedly gives them information in a near-death, while they're in a near-death state. So you could say years, more likely it's minutes. So it's not eternal life. So I would say, again, what it's not, it's not a particular religion. It's not all religions. It's not eternal life. And one more thing, a lot of the reports are of a specific wonderful place, let's just call it heaven, or in a lesser number of reports are of a very negative place, let's just call it hell. I don't think these near-death experiences can really tell us anything about the so-called furniture of hell or heaven. It might tell us something about those states, but to say I was in this place or that place is more difficult. You can tell the way I'm couching this that I'm still very careful about what we can say and not say. But having said all that, what can we say? And I think this is significant. What can we say? There appears to be what I would call minimalistic life after death. There appears to be something of our conscious that lives beyond our body. What form or what religion or whatever, from these data alone, I don't think we can tell.
Okay. So it would be fair to say that Carl Sagan and Bertrand Russell got a surprise.
Yeah, now that's a very interesting way to put it, because as you know, the quote-unquote conversion of Anthony Flew, who's been called the world's best-known philosophical atheist, the British philosopher, who about 3 years ago now, actually almost 4 years ago, reported becoming a theist. Tony and I have been friends for 20-some years, and I posed a Bertrand Russell-type question to him, and he was telling me the evidence that he thinks the evidence that caused him to believe in God after probably being the best. He's published more things on the philosophical defense of atheism than anybody. And now he's walked away from it. And I said, do you think Bertrand Russell's famous comment, there's not enough evidence to believe, do you think Bertrand Russell would be interested in the kind of data you think is out there? And he said, oh, yes. In fact, I think he said something like, I wouldn't be surprised if Bertrand Russell would have been side by side with me if he would have become a theist too. Now, if you apply that kind of thing to near-death experiences, I think that's another kind of experience that these guys would have to pay attention to. As a matter of fact, say Russell, and I mentioned Flew, they had a very well-known sidekick, A.J. Ayer, who's one of the best-known atheists of the last generation, Oxford professor, as was Tony Flew. And Ayer, just before his death, he had one or two near-death experiences. Ayer did. And Ayer wrote an article. I believe the name of the article was What I Saw When I Died. Now, Ayer is a naturalist and is an atheist. And for an atheist to say, what I saw when I died, seems to me even that title betrays some of the things you've asked about earlier. I don't know. I would think an atheist shouldn't see anything when they die. They should experience a state. They shouldn't experience any kind of state. That's the point. You can't experience a state in which you don't exist. So A.J. Ayer, before he finally did die, he said, I'm now more open to an afterlife than I was before. So, yeah, I mean, I think these sorts of things introduce states from which people could say, well, you can't tell which religion's true or that all religions are true, and I think that's so. I think you can't use NDEs to do that. But I think you can say, who's the odd man out here? What's the odd philosophy? And I think a strict naturalism that says the natural world is all there is, you're born, you live, you die, that's it, that's what we're most sure of in life, I think that kind of philosophy is most at odds with these findings.
Okay. So, you're a Christian. How does this NDE stuff play into your faith?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I am a Christian. During those 10 years of searching, I wondered if there, you know, it could Christianity be sustained, and I came to the conclusion it was, but like it could be. But like I said a moment ago, I don't think I can get there from near-death experiences. What near-death experiences helped me to see is that there's another reality out there, and somebody, or a lot of somebodies, are right that there's an afterlife. But it doesn't tell me which religion is true. How would I get from there's an afterlife to Christianity's true? Well, if that's all I knew, I don't think I could get there. But alongside near-death experiences, the only topic that I've spent more time studying than near-death experiences is the resurrection of Jesus. And I did my PhD dissertation on that subject many years ago at a secular university. And I argue that you can show that the resurrection is the best explanation of the historical data we have. And I do not mean that in terms of quoting the New Testament to somebody or saying, here we go in this Christian book, we have these Christian evidences. My thesis is what I call a minimal facts argument, and what I defended in my dissertation and in many books since then is that if I use the data about first century Palestine, if I use the historical data that is readily conceded by atheists, moderates, and conservatives alike, if I use only the atheist data, I have enough material to argue that the resurrection is the best explanation of what happened. So, in a nutshell, if you can get resurrection, and almost every critic who writes is willing to concede something like this, if you get a resurrection, then Christianity is looking really good. Of course, they're skeptics for a reason. They're not going to concede the resurrection. But if you concede the resurrection, now I have two evidences for an afterlife, two sets of evidences, resurrection and near-death experiences. One, near-death experiences is not religion-specific or is not worldview-specific, except to say naturalism looks like it's on tough times. But the resurrection is totally different. It not only says something against naturalism, it says something about a specific kind of religious belief. And if Jesus was raised from the dead, now you're dealing with the life and claims of Jesus.
Okay. Well, one last question. If people wanted to learn more about your work or near-death experiences, where would you recommend?
Well, I have a lot of books in print, but if somebody wants to, those are available from Amazon.com and other things, but if somebody just wants to not pay money and check some of the stuff out, because I'm not trying to make a buck, they can check my website out, which is simply Gary Habermas, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, GaryHabermas.com. And I have all kinds of video, audio, written responses, Q&A. There's even a game format that somebody can play. And I try to be fair. There's a bunch of debates. I shouldn't say a bunch, but there's probably half dozen or so dialogues, debates, discussions on my website with skeptics and atheists and different folks like that. And that people can watch it, they can see it, and nothing on my website is for sale. So it's all free of charge, and a person can check some of these things out, and there are plenty of items both on resurrection and on near-death experiences which they can check out for themselves.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Gary Habermas.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much for the interview.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Habermas, and I know I found it interesting to record, so hopefully it's giving you something to think about. And I'll talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.nl.